So constitutional law is our next topic. And you may wonder why constitutional law is an appropriate topic in a business law class. Usually when you think of business law, you want to think about commercial law, right? Contracts and all the commercial transactions and secured transactions and all kinds of things like that. But constitutional law sets the base for regulation. That's the big area of constitutional law that we have to look at. Remember, this course is split up into three segments. We just finished the first segment, which was the introductory segment. Now we're moving into the substantive law area, which is going to start out with constitutional law, and we'll look at torts and criminal law and contracts and those kinds of things. And then after we're finished with that, we move into the third section, which is regulation. Well, when we start talking about regulation, it's important for you to know as a business person, to what extent are you subject to regulation? And who can regulate, and on what basis, and if the government tries to over-regulate, what rights do you have to prevent the government from interfering with your right to engage in the free market system? So in order to understand that, we have to get a basic understanding of these constitutional principles, and that's ultimately going to come down to this Commerce Clause issue. So out of all of the topics that we're going to talk about in the first half of the constitutional law discussion, Commerce Clause is the big one. The other ones are going to be pretty quick. Bill of Rights, we have some kind of interesting issues. For those of you that are management majors or might be interested in engaging in human resource type activity when you get out into the work world, there are some major issues we have to deal with that First Amendment. And then we do have some ripple effects from the Fifth and the 14th Amendment, due process and equal protection issues that carry over into the business world. It's not just in courts that we have to worry about due process and equal protection. We sometimes have to provide that to people in the private sector as well. So that's why looking at those issues is going to become important. But basically, constitutional law just gives us that framework and tells us what the government can do and what the government can't do. Now, earlier we were talking about separation of powers just briefly. We looked at that Marbury case, and in that case, Justice Marshall said the courts can declare an action of Congress or the executive unconstitutional. That allows the courts to operate in that balance of powers, right? Sometimes, well, a lot of people call that a horizontal split or a horizontal separation of powers, because we have these three co-equal branches of government. We have the executive, the legislature, and the courts, and presumably they look at each other and what they're doing and make sure that no one branch gets too far out of whack. And we constantly see examples of that. And in the last 8 years, we've even seen some examples where the district courts, have enjoined the President of the United States from engaging in certain actions. So a lowly district court judge has told George Bush, President of the United States, most powerful person in the world, that he can't do something anymore. So it gives you a little bit of a sense of how that balance of power works, which is kind of neat. Now, in our system, we also have another separation of power that's very important, and a lot of people don't really think of this as separation of power, but this is a vertical, I call it a vertical separation, because we have a federal system. We have a system where we have to answer to two different kings. Now, in a business setting, those of you that have taken all the management classes and personnel classes and so on, does it make sense to have two bosses? If you go out and work, should you have two different bosses that you have to answer to all the time? Doesn't make sense to have that, right? Because those two bosses could impose different requirements on you, can really stress you out because they both might want something at the same time. It can cause all kinds of problems. It's not a good thing in a business environment to have two bosses. Now, it could be, right? If you're really good and skilled at this and you have two bosses, you can play one against the other. And maybe get out of doing a whole bunch of things, but that's a whole other side issue. So, but that's what we have at the federal level, because we have two different kings. We have the state government and we have the federal government to deal with. And both of them are potential regulators. Both of them have the ability to regulate business activity. So we have to know a little bit about where the limitations are and what government can do what. So when we look at that vertical separation, that's the focus. Now, when we talk about federal law, in our system, it's really neat because there are some other countries that mimic this now, but back in the 1700s when we came up with this, no other country had ever come up with this concept. The federal government's power is limited. It can only do what the Constitution says it can do. So if we can't find something in that Constitution that gives the federal government the power to act, it can't act. All of the other powers that aren't reserved in the Constitution belong to the states. Under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, all of that power goes to the state government. So technically, if you look at it from a sovereign standpoint, the states have more power than the federal government. Now, it doesn't seem that way because we know that the feds are the ones that pull all the strings now, right? The states usually respond to the feds. But so it doesn't look that way when you look at the economics. But if you look at it from a sovereign perspective, the states have more sovereignty than the federal government. So the federal constitution limits the federal government's ability to act. Typically, what the state constitutions do is they limit the state government's ability to act because the states can do anything they want unless their constitutions say they can't do it. So that split becomes important. Now, when we look at these issues, these four issues, Supremacy Clause, Contract Clause, Commerce Clause, and Bill of Rights, those are the only four things you need to know about in the constitutional law section. The first two we're going to be able to get rid of in about 5 minutes. The Supremacy Clause and the Contract Clause. There's not a lot of meat there. And this stuff you've already heard. I'm sure you've heard it in your history classes, in your civics classes, and in other forums and so on. The Supremacy Clause is real simple. It simply says that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. So if Congress passes a law that's inconsistent with the Constitution, guess what happens to the law? Gets struck down, right? The courts are going to say, unconstitutional, you can't do that. Why? Because the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Now, this is going to become important when we look at regulation. Because if the Constitution gives Congress, gives the federal government, the power to regulate business, and the government says it's going to regulate business, it can do something called preempt the states. This preemption concept comes into play because of the Supremacy Clause. Now, all preemption means is that the federal government has expressed an intent to take over regulation in a certain area and that they want to be the sole source of regulation. So traditionally, business regulation was all done at the state level. But occasionally, something happens, Enron, WorldCom, some big corporate debacle like that, or maybe some of the stuff we're seeing now with the credit crisis and the fall of all the brokerage firms and the markets tanking and everything. What's Congress talking about? What are people talking about? We need more regulation. We can't let this happen again, right? They're talking about regulation. That's always their solution. If Congress comes in and says, we want to take over, what they're doing is they're preempting. That's what we call preemption. Now, the nice thing about preemption and the Supremacy Clause is if Congress comes in and preempts the states, it's nice and easy for us as business people because all we have to do is follow federal law. We never even have to look at state law. And if the state tries to regulate in that area, guess what? The court's going to say it's unconstitutional. The court's going to decree it unconstitutional. So we can just stick our nose up at the states and say, you can say whatever you want, but I'm not following it. I don't have to follow it. Congress has preempted. So that's the Supremacy Clause. Does that make sense to everybody? And you've heard that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. I'm sure you've heard that before as well. So that's the font of governmental power in the U.S. Okay, the Contract Clause. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution. Article 1 deals with all the legislative powers. So that's where you'll see all of this because all of these powers to regulate are given to the legislature primarily. The executive, the president, just enforces those laws. So Article 1, Section 10, Contract Clause, says that the states may not impair the obligations of contracts. Now, why is that important for business purposes? Why should we care whether or not the states have the ability to impair the obligation of contract? I know we haven't gone over contract law yet, but what is business? If you boil it down to its essence, business is just one big contract negotiation. That's all it is. So if I engage in a negotiation here in Rhode Island to sell something, sell some goods, sell some product to some other company in another state, and that state can say, we're going to invalidate the contract. Are my economic rights protected? No. Now, in the United States, we have this strange concept because all the states are sovereign, but we all have to work together like we're one big country. And we tend to do that. We tend to work together like we're one big country. So the states, if the states have the individual authority to interfere with the obligations of contracts, the states could basically shut down your ability to conduct business across state lines. And they could create all kinds of preferences for companies in their state to get all the business to those companies. And that wouldn't be very good for the free market system. Because in a free market system, what do we need? We need lots of suppliers, lots of producers, so that the market can set prices on goods and services and can allocate resources. Ultimately, that's what we're looking for. So if the states start to micromanage and try and benefit their people, if Rhode Island just passed all kinds of laws benefiting Rhode Island businesses that, and kind of shut out Connecticut and Massachusetts and all these other states, we wouldn't really have a well-developed national economy. We would have never gotten to the point where we are now. We would have never gone through the Industrial Revolution. It just wouldn't have happened. So the states can't impair the obligation of contract. Now, I kept on saying, the states cannot impair the obligation of contract. Can the federal government impair the obligation of contract? Absolutely. Feds can do whatever they want. Now, why would we want to give the federal government the obligation to invalidate a contract? Let's say that I have... Okay, right. We might have a concern if somebody's trying to usurp so much market power that they're taking away opportunity from everybody else. So we may, and in fact the government did that specifically. When we get to antitrust law, which is a type of regulation, the reason that came about was John Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller and the Standard Oil Trust. And that why the reason it's called antitrust is he formed this trust and he put all of the oil companies in the United States in one trust that he controlled. So the whole purpose of that area of regulation was to break up that trust so we could have a free market. So that might be one reason. But let's say that I am a nuclear physicist, really smart person. I know all that nuclear science stuff. And I have a company that provides consulting and provides products for companies that run nuclear reactors and so on. And this guy, Mahmoud Mahmoud, how do you pronounce his name? The guy, the president of Iraq. Yes, I can't, for some reason I always get tongue-tied when I try and pronounce his last name. But Mahmoud calls me up and says, I'd like to buy some reactor cores, some of your nuclear reactor cores. I say, oh, that sounds like a good deal. I'll sell them to you for this amount. He says, fine. No price is too high. I'll be more than happy to pay that. Why should Congress be able to cut or prevent me from doing that?
Because they don't want to sell that to our technical enemies.
Okay, it's a national security issue, right? There are some concerns that are going to trump business. And when we go to national security, and when we go to a potential threat to the market system itself, and our way of government and our way of life itself, the government's got to have an ability to stop that from happening, so they can do that. And they've done this consistently over time. Another example, if any of you like cigars, Cuban cigars, right? You couldn't, I guess you can get them now, but in the for years, there was an import ban on Cuban cigars, and they cut off all contracts when we had that little Bay of Pigs issue down there in the 1960s with Cuba. So they just, Congress decided, no more imports from Cuba. All contracts with Cuban cigar producers are void. They can do it. So remember, the states can't, but the federal government can. That's the contract clause. And that's really important to have in the Constitution because it protects our right to participate in the economic system. That's the key. Whether or not we can participate in the economic system. All right, any questions on that? I went a little bit over the 5 minutes I predicted on those two, but not too much over that. That leaves us with the Commerce Clause. And the Commerce Clause is the font of federal regulation of business. This is the genesis of all federal regulation, for at least for our purposes. Now, the Commerce Clause is fairly simple, and it is a clause. It's not even a full sentence. It's Article 1, Section 8. One clause in Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. That's what it says. So there are two specific grants of authority to Congress in that Commerce Clause. Congress can regulate foreign commerce, anything that crosses the U.S. boundary. And it can also regulate interstate commerce. Interstate commerce is any commerce that crosses state lines. So we have a specific grant of authority to Congress to regulate in those two areas. Now note that there's no grant for Congress to regulate intra-state commerce. Intra-state commerce. That would be commerce that occurs within one specific state. Now let's say that I have a company and I'm a diehard Rhode Islander. I have this company. I set it up in Rhode Island. I only hire Rhode Island people to work there. I only buy stuff from other Rhode Island companies to produce my goods and services. And I will only sell my product to Rhode Island citizens. I won't sell it to anybody from Connecticut or Vermont or New Hampshire or Massachusetts. I keep everything solely within the state. Can Congress regulate it? Doesn't look like it, because that looks like it's all intrastate commerce, right? That's all happening within the state. And originally, when this was interpreted, when the Constitution was written back in the 1700s, and for about the first 130 years or so when the courts interpreted this clause, that's exactly what they said. They said that intrastate commerce is stuff that literally goes across state lines. So if we kept everything within the state, there'd be no ability of the federal government to regulate. That would solely be a state issue. So you have to cross the state line. Now, what happened, though, about 130, 140 years after the Constitution was adopted, is we started to change economic systems, didn't we? What did we have initially when we first formed the country? What kind of economic base did we have? What was the primary generator of wealth?
Agrarian,
right. Agriculture. It was agriculture. If you had land, if you had farms, if you had animals, you were wealthy. If you didn't have those things, you weren't wealthy. Now, if you have an agrarian type economy, you don't really need a lot of federal regulation. Because if, especially in those days, if you're going to produce all this food, how far can you take it before it's going to rot? Right? You can't take it very far. You can sell it to in the local market, but you can't really, in those days, you couldn't ship it to the West Coast and expect it to be good at that time. But when we moved to the Industrial Revolution, there was a fundamental shift in the economy. We're seeing another one of these fundamental shifts now, by the way. We're moving from industrial to information-based economy, and a whole bunch of things are changing there as well. But when we moved to the industrial-based economy, we moved everybody off the farms, into the cities, into the factories, right? And we created these larger bases of capital. How did we get to the point we are now? We got people to invest money in enterprises that could produce products and services that they could sell across the board, right? All across the country and even in foreign countries. And those kept getting bigger and bigger. That's what caused the industrial growth in the country. This concentration of capital and investment of capital and those kinds of resources. So things changed a little bit when the Industrial Revolution started. And going back to your economics classes, let's just go back to very, very simple economics and go back to my Rhode Island example. If I have a company in Rhode Island, and let's say it's an industrial-based company, and I'm producing widgets, some kind of industrial item that other people want. So I'm producing widgets. If I only buy materials in Rhode Island, I only sell in Rhode Island, I only hire in Rhode Island, is there any impact on interstate commerce? If my company stopped doing that, would there be an impact on the widget market in Connecticut and Massachusetts? Why? You're absolutely right. Why?
Because even if you're just applying to Rhode Island,
right, you're reducing supply, aren't you? Now, if you reduce supply, what's going to happen? It's going to increase price. It could have an increase in price, and it has an impact on competition, doesn't it? So if I disappear, then a whole bunch of other people are going to come into Rhode Island and try and sell widgets in Rhode Island. So even though I'm solely based in Rhode Island, I'm only acting in Rhode Island, what's really happening is I'm impacting interstate commerce, aren't I? So what the courts tried to do, and what they did successfully, actually, after a while, is they said that when we look at this interstate commerce issue, We don't look to see whether or not the stuff actually crosses the state line. All we have to do is we have to determine that the activity impacts interstate commerce. And if the activity impacts interstate commerce, we can regulate it. You see what happened there? Now that's a perfect example of the courts expanding the law to take into consideration current circumstances and events. That's the common law and process. It's taking the same, nobody changed the language in the Constitution, but now the courts have expanded Congress's role to allow regulation of anything that impacts interstate commerce, even if it's solely within a state. Does that make sense? Does everybody see how that can apply? Okay. Good. Now let's take a look at a couple of examples. Foreign commerce. That's real easy. If it's foreign commerce, Congress can absolutely regulate it. And a few years ago, we had the Congress was actually trying to do a public relations campaign. Sounds like they should be doing it now. I think they have now a 14% approval rating. That's even lower than the president's approval rating right now. So the horrible approval rating. But they were sending ex-congressmen to all the universities around the country, and they were telling stories about their days in Congress and how wonderful it was and trying to get everybody interested in the process and all. We had a team of congressmen, ex-congressmen from New York come here, and I let them come into the business law class, and actually it was really good because one of them was Congressman Worley, who was from upstate New York back in the late 80s and early 1990s, and he told this story about how when he was in Congress, he had this factory in his district that produced this electronic switch that was patented. The company owned the patent. They were the only ones that could produce it, and it had revolutionized some kind of electronic delivery or I don't know anything about the technical side, so I can't tell you all the specifics. But it was a novel product, and it was going gangbusters in the United States. But the company obviously wanted to start selling that product overseas. So the congressman had a diplomatic mission at one time. I guess he went over to Japan, and for some diplomatic reason. And he thought, while I'm here, what I'll do is I'll meet with a couple of Japanese executives from the big electronics firms and see if I can get them to buy this product from this factory in my district. Now, why should a United States congressman care whether the Japanese company buys the product from this factory? What's he getting at there? Why should he care? He can make that happen. What happens?
He gets votes.
He gets votes, right? People are working. People are employed. They're making money. If the company's doing well, they're probably going to pay the people that work there pretty well, and it has kind of a ripple effect. So it's in his interest to keep the people in his district happy. So if he can be successful at selling those little circuits, then that'll help him get reelected. So he met with these executives, and he couldn't speak Japanese, so they had to have an interpreter. And they're going back and forth, I guess, for about a half hour or so, and he was telling them all the benefits of this. And finally, the executive said, well, this sounds very interesting, but we're not really interested in buying these because we think that a Japanese company will come up with something very, very similar that won't violate the patent, and we'd rather buy it from the Japanese company. But what we'd like you to do is we'd like you to go back because we have these other products that we're trying to get into U.S. markets and so on, and we already have established contracts and so on. So why don't we talk about that instead of trying whether or not we're going to buy your product because we're not interested. So Willie stood up and said, oh, well, I understand where you're coming from, but all of that stuff you're talking about with your products coming into the United States, you won't have to worry about that anymore. And then he just stood up and turned around and started to walk out the door. And of course, the executives were a little taken aback by that. And I said, well, what do you mean we're not going to have to worry about that? We want to be able to distribute our product. He said, well, you see, what I'm going to do when I leave here is I have my government jet waiting for me, and I'm going to go back to Washington. And as soon as I get off the plane in Washington, I'm going to walk into the United States House of Representatives, and I'm going to go into my committee and pass a bill that puts an import embargo on all products from your company. And I'm going to hand deliver that bill, once it passes the House of Representatives, to my good friends in the Senate. And then once they pass it, and it will pass the Senate because I have good friends over there, I'm going to march it down personally to my good friend Ronald Reagan, the President of the United States. He's going to sign that bill. So you won't have to worry about any of those problems that you were having with getting your product into the United States, because it's not going to be allowed in the United States. What do you think? Could he do it? Would it be appropriate for him to do that? Would it be appropriate, and could he do it? This is a real live case. This is what actually happened. This what kind of makes it neat. What do you think?
I think it wouldn't be appropriate, but he could do it if he wanted to.
Yeah, well, why wouldn't it be appropriate?
Because he's just acting on, like, being upset over the business decision to have.
Well, Japan's closing its markets to U.S. companies, so he wants to close U.S. markets to Japanese companies. Not the best economic decision in the long run, right? If we look at microecon principles, we don't want to have all those kinds of embargoes and tariffs and so on. It doesn't make sense in the long run for allocation of resources and maximizing utility. But if Japan's going to cut us out, maybe it's okay for him to try and cut them out. So he may not agree with it philosophically, but he might be able to do it. Now, could he actually do it? Let's say he had the political clout to make that happen. He could get it past the House, he could get it past the Senate, and he could literally walk into the Oval Office and get the President of the United States to sign it. If that went to court, what would a court say? Did you have a... No? So let's say it happened. It goes to court, and it's in front of the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court has to determine whether or not that action was permissible. What's the court going to say? And in this case, I think it would be a per curiam decision, which means all 9 justices would agree. This would be a slam dunk in the Supreme Court. What would they say? Would they knock it down? How many say they'd knock it down? How many say they'd uphold it? Okay, most people don't want to vote, huh? Most people don't want to vote. They'd uphold it. Why? Right. Commerce Clause says that the federal government has the absolute right to regulate foreign commerce. So because of that, the Supreme Court cannot strike that down as unconstitutional, because that's a specific grant to Congress in the Constitution. Everybody see that? Now, it may not be the best thing to do. I'm not trying to argue in any way that that's the best thing to do, because economically it's not. But if it happened, the Supreme Court would be forced to accept it. Kind of an interesting scenario. So that's foreign commerce. Now let's talk about interstate commerce for a second. And let me give you another example. Let's say that I am the mayor of Providence. And one of the problems I have as mayor of Providence is all these noisy planes fly over my citizens' houses starting at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they keep flying over them until 10 or 11 o'clock at night when the airport closes. So I own the airport. City of Providence owns TF Green Airport. I'm going to make my citizens happy by opening the airport at 10 in the morning and closing it at 4 in the afternoon. What do you think? Can the mayor of Providence do that? Definitely not. Why? Okay, bingo. And that's what you're going to see consistently throughout this course. When you look at actions, what you want to look for is if there's going to be an impact on someone else where somebody else's rights are being compromised. Now, in this example, other people's rights are being compromised. If we shut down the Providence Airport in those odd hours, it's only open from 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, would that have an impact on interstate commerce? Absolutely. Because it's going to impede the free flow of people and goods and products, all kinds of things, through the economic system. So the federal government can regulate. And the federal government does regulate in that area. They say if you have an airport, it has to be open at such and such a time, and it has to close at such and such a time. And if I don't like it, that's too bad. I'm going to have to follow those rules, even though those planes are flying right over the houses of those people that are at the end of the runway, right? So this always happens at airports. The airports have the runway, and then all these people come in and they buy cheap land at the end of the runway, and they build these big houses, and then 6 months later they're complaining because of all the noise. Well, the runway was there first. The airport was there first, but that's going to pose a problem. So that's going to interfere with interstate commerce, and we're going to see this in just a second. Now, actually, let's do that. Let's go through that analysis first, and then we can come back and talk about the limitations for a second. Now, if this is the analysis that we would go through on a Commerce Clause issue. And we're going to see this exhibited in a case. When we look at the Granholm case, the court does exactly this. Now, I've mapped it out. I've made it a little bit easier to understand. But when you read Granholm, and hopefully you've at least skimmed it for tonight, because we might get to talk a little bit about it in a few minutes, this is kind of what's going on. Now, there are three potential ways that business can be regulated in the United States. We can have preemption under the Supremacy Clause. If there's preemption under the Supremacy Clause, what rules do we follow? Federal. Because the federal government has said, we want to regulate here, and we don't want the states to interfere. So if you see preemption, then the federal rules are going to govern. Now, preemption is very rare. And in order for a court to find that the federal government has preempted the states, there has to be specific language in the enabling statute that says something like, we intend to take over regulation, or we intend to set aside all state regulation. So if it's very clear that Congress intended to take over in the area and cut out the states, we've got preemption and federal law applies. So that's pretty easy. Now another option, that's on this side, is also very easy, where we have no federal regulation. Here we only have the potential for state regulation. So if there's no federal regulation in the area, what do we follow? State law. That's real easy. We follow the state law. Now, what's an example of that? You don't see too much of that these days, but one classic example of state-only regulation is insurance. Those of you that are finance majors might be working for insurance companies. Lots of finance people are needed to run those portfolios that the insurance companies have and to manage all the financial assets and so on. All of the insurance regulation in the United States is based at the state level. Why? The federal government doesn't want to regulate. It's looked at this in the past, and it said the state regulation is sufficient. The state regulation is doing its job. We have no reason to come in and regulate. So they actually passed a law back in the 1940s called McCarran-Ferguson that said, while they have the right to regulate, they're choosing not to because the states are doing such a good job. Now, what's the problem with state regulation, though? Now, here we only have to follow the state rules. We don't have to worry about federal. But if we have to follow state rules, what's the problem? Exactly. We have 50 different states. And every time we conduct business in a different state, we may have a different set of rules to follow. So one of the problems with this part of the matrix, if you want to think of it that way, is that when we're over here, we could have a whole bunch of different rules to follow, and that's going to cost a lot. From an administrative standpoint, it increases the cost of doing business. So sometimes you could even argue that federal regulation is better, because at least you have one set of rules and you don't have to worry about all the variations between the states. But these are two real easy situations to notice. Now, when you get to analysis on the quizzes and tests and in business, where it gets tricky is when we get to dual regulation. If the federal government does not preempt the states, and the states are also regulating, we have two kings telling us what to do. Right? We have the feds and we have the state. They're both telling us what to do. So now we have two bosses. So we have to have a way of figuring out which rules to follow. What do we follow in that case? Well, there are three potential situations that can result from that. We can have what's called an irreconcilable conflict between the laws. We could have an undue burden. And if I finish that out, it would be an undue burden on interstate commerce. And then the last one, we have affirmative discrimination. So there are only three potential scenarios if you have dual regulation. It's got to be one of those three. So whenever you look at a fact situation, all you have to do is think of those three and peg it into the right category. Now, irreconcilable conflict is the easiest of the three. So let me explain what happens here. It's pretty obvious from the name. It's pretty obvious what happens here. Irreconcilable conflict means that it's impossible to follow both the federal and the state law. If you follow the federal law, you'll be breaking the state law. And if you follow the state law, you'll be breaking the federal law. So no matter what you do, somebody's going to be ticked off. Right? One of the two kings is going to be ticked off. Now, when that happens, if there's an irreconcilable conflict, if it's impossible to follow both laws, what do you think happens? What do you think the result's going to be here? Go back to a basic principle, first one we talked about. Supremacy clause. If there's an irreconcilable conflict, who wins? The feds. Why? Because the Supreme, the federal constitution says that it is the supreme law of the land. So it's going to trump all other federal law and all other state statutes. So if it's impossible to comply with both of the laws, the federal rules are going to apply. So all you have to do is follow federal rules. Pretty easy. So once you determine something's an irreconcilable conflict, follow federal rules. It's that simple. Undue burden is a little bit different. With undue burden, what we have to do is we have to look to see what the impact is on interstate commerce. So if both the state and the federal government are regulating, and it's possible to comply with both, but the state government imposes regulation that causes an undue burden on interstate commerce, then we got a problem. Now this is a tougher one to resolve because, and you've got the scales of justice there, you got to weigh the facts. You got to look at the situation and determine whether or not this constitutes an undue burden. So the courts have to do this, right? But let's go back to our airport example. Let's say that I know, because I know a little bit about this constitutional law stuff, and I'm the mayor of Providence, so I know that I can't pass local legislation that says this airport won't open until 10 and we'll close at 4 in the afternoon, because that would be what? That would be an irreconcilable conflict with federal law, wouldn't it? If the feds say it has to open at 5 in the morning and it has to stay open until 12 at night, I can't follow both. Well, I could follow both, but if I follow the local law, we've got a problem. So what I do, instead of saying that the airport's going to be closed, is I say, any airplane that lands, now I don't know if you know how the airports work, but every time an airplane lands, they pay a landing fee, and every time they take off, they pay a departure fee, and that's how they get the money to run the airport and pay for all the air traffic controllers and so on. So I don't know what it costs to take off and land, but probably $5,000 or $6,000 or something like that normally to take off and land. Well, let's say that I know that people aren't going to pay an awful lot for that, so I passed local legislation in Providence that says that if you land the plane between 5 in the morning and 10 in the morning, the landing fee is $50,000. Where the takeoff fee is $50,000, and if you do it after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's $50,000. Is it possible to comply with both laws? Is it possible to comply with both the federal and the state law? Yeah, it's possible. But what's the real impact of that legislation, that local legislation? What am I trying to do as the mayor of Providence? Do I really want to collect the $50,000? It's not a realistic sum, so what am I doing? In effect, I'm closing down the airport between those hours, aren't I? So you could argue that that would constitute an undue burden on interstate commerce because it's preventing people from going through that airport, and that's delaying the shipment of goods and services, and it's delaying people who are engaged in commerce. So that could be an undue burden on interstate commerce. So that's undue burden. We'll see examples of this in a little bit. I just want to get the basic structure out, and then we'll look at some examples later tonight, and then also next time, because we're not going to finish this tonight. And then the third area is affirmative discrimination. And as you know, anytime you see this word, right, this is a bad thing for this ground. By the way, if we do have an undue burden, if there is an undue burden, what law do we follow? Federal. So if yes, we follow the feds. If no, if there's not an undue burden, what do we have to do? We have to comply with both sets of rules. We have to comply with both the federal rules and the state rules. So if there's not an undue burden, then you have to follow federal and state regulation over here. Now, affirmative discrimination is another type of analysis, and usually where this applies is when the state tries to protect in-state businesses. This is typically where you see it. So if you are running a business in Rhode Island, one set of rules applies to you. But if I'm running a business in Connecticut and I'm trying to conduct business in Rhode Island, it's the exact same business. I have to jump through a whole bunch of additional hoops just to sell my product in Rhode Island. What the state's trying to do is discriminate against out-of-state businesses to give the in-state businesses a competitive advantage. That's what affirmative discrimination is. So when a state does that, what do you think? What's your gut say? Is that a good thing to do? Should I have double standards when we're looking at economic activity? Should I treat a Rhode Island company different than a Connecticut company when they're doing exactly the same thing? Probably not. But there may be circumstances where it's reasonable to do that. So if there's, for example, a concern, and when we get to police powers, we'll talk about some limitations on this. The government has the obligation, it's more than the authority, it's the obligation to protect the public health, safety, welfare, and morals. That's what we call the police powers. So if in pursuing that obligation, they believe they have to have a little bit more oversight over out-of-state businesses because they don't have direct control over them, that may be okay. It may be okay to subject those businesses to a little bit of additional oversight. But in order for it to be okay, we have to meet two standards. First of all, there has to be a legal purpose for the discrimination, for treating the out-of-state businesses differently than the in-state businesses. So we have to have a legal purpose. And then secondly, the state has to take the least restrictive means possible in order to achieve that legal purpose. So we're not just going to let them say, oh, well, I'm protecting my citizens and I want to protect public morals, so I'm going to pass this regulation to make it harder for out-of-state businesses to do business in Rhode Island. That's not enough. There has to be a legal purpose, and the state has to be taking the least restrictive means of achieving that. If this happens, if you comply with both of these, even if you're affirmatively discriminating against out-of-state companies, if the states meet these two standards, then you've got to comply with both federal regulation and state regulation. So you have dual regulation in that case. If you find that there was no legal purpose, or the states didn't take the minimum approach to dealing with that issue, then you only have to follow the federal. So just because something discriminates doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. We're going to talk a lot about discrimination when we get to employment law in the regulation section of this course. Those of you that are management majors are going to need to know a little bit about that. If you're going to be hiring people, firing people, dealing with human resources issues, that comes up all the time. Discrimination is a key thing. But discrimination itself isn't bad. Discrimination is not bad at all. It's when we use discrimination in an impermissible way that it becomes bad. I discriminate every day. My job is to discriminate. Right? I'm discriminating between those who know this material and those who don't when I assign grades. So I do it every day. There's a discrimination process going on. But is that permissible? Sure, because I'm not doing it based on race, religion, creed, national origin, sex, or state citizenship, or anything like that. There's no artificial way of doing that. You either know the material or you don't. That's how we're kind of assigning the grades, or at least that's presumably how the grade should be assigned in a college class. So discrimination isn't necessarily bad, but we need to jump through these two hoops in order for the state regulation to apply. Does everybody see that? So, whenever you get a Commerce Clause type issue, if you can remember this matrix, you can analyze any situation that comes up at you. And this is exactly what the courts do. They go through this exact process. First thing they look to see is whether or not there's any preemption, because if there is, it's a real easy answer, right? Ignore the state and pay attention to the feds. And if there's no federal regulation, it's a real easy answer. Ignore the Fed. Well, there's nothing to ignore. There's no regulation at all. Just follow the state law. But if there's no preemption and the state's regulating as well, we have to test it on these three bases to determine whether or not the state regulation is constitutional. And that's the process we're going to go through. Now, there are a couple of limitations. Let me mention this, and then we'll actually go through this process with the Granholm case. There are a couple of limitations on this Commerce Clause power that the federal government has. And I listed them here: police powers and state taxation. I already mentioned what police powers are. Police powers are the, I call them obligations. The state has an obligation to protect public health, safety, welfare, and morals. So if they don't, if they don't do that, if they don't take that responsibility seriously, they really shouldn't have the sovereign power that they have. Sovereignty comes with that obligation. So if the state, and that's why when we look at this area over here with affirmative discrimination, if the state's exercising police powers, and in the exercise of those police powers thinks we need to discriminate against out-of-state businesses, if we meet those requirements, it's okay. If we don't, it's not okay. So that's where that limitation on police powers comes in. Usually where you'll see it, at least, is in this area of affirmative discrimination. Now the other area is taxation, state taxation. And this is kind of obvious. We know that governments tax, right? Governments need money to operate, so they need to tax us. Now, if let's say you own a shipping company, a worldwide shipping company. You ship those containers all over the world. You have those big ships and go all over the world. And you come into the Port of Providence. And when you pull into the Port of Providence, the tax collector's there and says, I want $2 for every container that's on the ship. Do you think that violates federal law? Now, is that interstate or foreign commerce? What is it? That's going to be foreign, right? Because it's probably coming from some other country, coming into the United States, coming into the port. So it's probably foreign commerce. Congress has the exclusive right to regulate that, don't they? Regulate foreign commerce. So can the state tax those containers coming in?
Sure.
They can, as long as it's reasonable. Now, they can't. Now, I couldn't, if I, let's say in Providence, there was a big controversy over the big container ships coming up and blocking everybody's sailboat races. And I don't want the big container ships coming in because I'm up for election and I want to make everybody happy. So I say we're going to have a $50,000 tax per container that comes in. Now am I interfering with Congress's right to regulate? Yeah, I am, because they have the absolute right to regulate foreign commerce. So it's a matter of degree. Not all of this stuff is crystal clear. Now, obviously, if I was going to give you a question on an exam or something like this, it'd have to be pretty clear one way or the other. It wouldn't be fair to give you something right in the middle, because, unless it's an essay question, and then we can argue both sides. So when you get to the midterm, you might have that where you can argue it either way. But on the multiple choice type things, like we saw earlier, it'd have to be really clear one way or the other. $2, that's probably okay. Why? Because it costs the city money to run the port, doesn't it? So if they collect a few dollars per container that goes through the port and that covers the operations of the port, that's a legitimate way of the state, or a legitimate purpose for the state to regulate. So indirectly it's regulation, but it's still permissible as long as it's reasonable. So these are the limitations on the Commerce Clause power of the federal government. Okay, now let's take a quick look at the Granholm case. Granholm versus Heald. This was a recent case, 2005, and this made quite a stir, actually, in the wine markets about alcohol. So kind of interesting topic, right? So Granholm versus Heald. Now this was actually two cases coming together. And what did it deal with? Anybody remember? Basic facts. Just give me the basic facts. You don't have to get into any details.
Beer producers were putting a lot of extra things that out-of-state wine producers had to do to sell directly to their consumers.
Okay.
And things like that, I guess.
Right. Then we have these two court processes, and they went up to the appellate courts, and then they merged them together when they went up to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court was looking at both of these court processes. Now let me just tell you a little bit about the background here. In the Michigan law said if you're an out-of-state winery, you have to jump through all kinds of hoops to sell your wine in Michigan. You have to go through in-state wholesalers, and you have to meet all kinds of additional requirements. But if you were a winery in Michigan, you don't have to meet those requirements. Now, what does this sound like? Just right off the bat, what does it sound like? discrimination, right? Affirmative discrimination. And that's ultimately the issue in the case. But Michigan's trying to discriminate against out-of-state businesses by imposing additional burdens on them to conduct business in Michigan. And that went through the courts, and what the courts determined in the Michigan case, what the appellate court determined, was that the Michigan law was unconstitutional. They said it violated the Commerce Clause authority of Congress and was therefore unconstitutional. Now in New York, we had a similar type thing, not quite the same thing, but a similar type thing. New York didn't really impose all these burdens like Michigan did on the distribution of out-of-state wine in New York, but they said that if you want to have free access to sell your wine in New York, your wine has to be made, at least 75% of the grapes that make your wine have to come from New York. And they imposed that requirement on both New York wineries and out-of-state wineries. So in the New York example, we have one law that applies to both in-state and out-of-state that says essentially that 75% of the grapes making this wine has to come from New York in order for this set of rules to apply. And if you don't meet that requirement, then another set of rules applies. And that went up to the appellate court, and the appellate court thought that one was constitutional. Now, why would you think the appellate court might think that's constitutional? Does that look like it's discriminating? It's the same rule that applies to in-state and out-of-state wineries, isn't it? Kind of the same rule. So there, we have different approaches. Both states are trying to protect their in-state industry. They're taking different approaches to doing it. Michigan's directly saying that if you're out of state, you've got to jump through all these additional hoops. New York is just saying, we're going to impose this standard and everybody has to meet it. Now, with the New York case, let's think about this. If you're a New York winery, where do you think your grapes are going to come from? New York, right? If I'm a California winery, am I going to want to import 75% of the grapes that make my wine from New York? Or am I going to want to take them off the vines in the backyard? I don't want to take them off the vines in the backyard. So even though the same rule applies to the two different businesses, in-state and out-of-state, does it have an impact on the out-of-state that might be a little bit heavier than the impact on the in-state wineries? Sure. These in-state wineries probably, by definition, have 100% of the grapes making that wine coming from New York grapes.
Can New York also require that?
Right. They needed a brick and mortar type presence, so they had to have some kind of physical location. Absolutely. So that's kind of where these cases came in. Now, the Supreme Court took this case. Now, you might wonder, why should the Supreme Court care about a bunch of wine distributors? Right? What kind of issue is that? It gets to this Commerce Clause issue. It's definitely a Commerce Clause issue. Now, let's just go through this analysis, and the court did exactly what's on that board. Pretty much went through that little structure over there, but let's go through it and see what the court said about this. First thing, do we have preemption? Is it true that only Congress regulates the distribution of wine and alcoholic beverages in the United States? I assume you know that, especially if you're from New Hampshire. Anybody from New Hampshire? No? Nobody from New Hampshire? The New Hampshire state liquor stores, right? The states have, in fact, the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution preserves that right for the states. After Prohibition, the 21st Amendment, you should know the 21st, right? If we didn't have the 21st Amendment, you can't go out on Friday night and have a good time. You wouldn't be able to, still have Prohibition in place. 21st repealed Prohibition and gave the states the rights to regulate this. So can we ever have preemption when we're looking at alcoholic beverages? We can't have it. Even if Congress tried to preempt, if they came out and said in legislation that we're going to take over, what would the Supreme Court say about that legislation if it went up to the Supreme Court? Unconstitutional. The 21st Amendment preserves those rights to the states, but so therefore we can't have preemption. Now, because of that 21st Amendment, and the states tried to argue this, does that mean that only the states can regulate the distribution of alcohol within their borders? Is that what the states try to argue that? They said the 21st Amendment says that regulation of alcohol across state borders is reserved to the states. Therefore, the only thing that matters is what we say. And since we're regulating the distribution of alcohol, Congress, you can't get involved. What do you think about that argument?
limited in the Constitution. So the feds could do it.
Right. Now, did the Constitution, the 21st Amendment, we haven't read that, but the 21st Amendment does say the states have the ability to control that, but the Constitution also grants Congress the power to control what? Anything that crosses state lines in interstate commerce. Right? So, with the Commerce Clause power in place, do you think we can only have state regulation? No. No, we can't. There's going to be a balance. The states tried to argue that we should only have state regulation. We should be in this box. But what the court said, and it cited prior precedent to show this, the court said, yes, you have the right to regulate within your state. However, you cannot regulate in a way that takes away Congress's authority to control interstate commerce under the Commerce Clause. That's essentially what the court said. So basically where they put us was right in the middle with dual regulation. So we have this dual regulation concept. Now, let's go through each one just for good measure. Irreconcilable conflict. Is it impossible to comply with federal? Well, first of all, how much federal regulation do you think there is on this? Virtually none, right? The only reason this is coming up is because somebody sued New York and somebody sued Michigan because New York and Michigan were taking away their economic opportunities. And under the Constitution, you have the right to participate in the economic system. You won't see that stated in the Constitution, but it's implied that you have a right to participate in the free market. So somebody sued and said that their rights were violated, and there's really no federal regulation, so can we have an irreconcilable conflict between federal and state law? Is this where we're going to be on this? No, we're not going to have an irreconcilable conflict because there really isn't any federal regulation specifically on this. Now, undue burden. What about an undue burden? Can you argue that the states have tried to impose an undue burden? You could argue that, but could you argue that no undue burden was imposed too? Would you be able to look at this case and say with certainty that the states have imposed an undue burden on interstate commerce? They may have imposed an undue burden on specific wine dealers who want to participate in that state, but in order to find that there's an undue burden in interstate commerce, we have to have tons of data. We have to have all the economists come in and give us all the econometric studies and show that there is some kind of burden on interstate commerce itself. So that's a really tough thing to prove, unless you're willing to go through all those hoops to get all the data. And they weren't willing to do that in this case. So that kind of leaves us with the affirmative discrimination issue. Does it seem pretty clear that Michigan and New York were trying to discriminate against the out-of-state people? What do you think? Yeah, I think that's pretty clear, right? They were trying to discriminate. But that's not enough. And the court says that. In the language of the case, they say specifically that it's discriminatory, but that's not where we have to end the analysis. Because if the state action is discriminatory, the state regulation could still be upheld if it had a legitimate purpose and the regulation was no more restrictive than what it had to be in order to achieve that purpose. So even though the state's discriminating, we may still have to follow the state regulation. Does anybody remember what the states argued here? When we got to this point in the case, the states came up with all kinds of reasons why they had a legitimate purpose for regulating and that it was least restrictive. How did they argue that?
Michigan said that they're trying to prevent underage drinking.
Okay. And New York came up with that too. Right? So underage drinking, they don't want underage people getting access to booze, and since we're dealing with mail order, this was mail order distribution of wine, and if you're underage, it might be a lot easier to get a box of wine through mail order than showing up at the local liquor store and getting a box, right? So Michigan said, well, that's why we did this. We did this to protect the public. We want to protect minors from the evils of alcohol, and we want to make sure that they don't have easy access and get into bad habits early in life so that they lose potential and aren't able to fulfill their true potential. What do you think, that argument? If the state requires out-of-state producers, now this is the Michigan law, so the state was requiring out-of-state producers to go through local wholesalers, but in-state producers didn't have to go through local wholesalers. If you wanted to buy a box of wine from an in-state producer, you could just go on their website, click a few buttons, and the box of wine would show up on your door a few days later. So was that really controlling access for minors? If minors wanted to buy wine, what would they do? Would they buy it from out-of-state wineries? Who would they buy it from? The in-state. Because the in-state, there wouldn't be any restrictions, and they could get access to it. So if Michigan was really concerned with underage drinking, they would have imposed the same rules on both in-state and out-of-state wineries, wouldn't they? There would have been something directly targeted to preventing minors from being able to buy wine. But that wasn't the case here. And New York tried to make that argument, too. They have an interest in protecting the public from the dangers of underage drinking and operating motor vehicles and all that kind of stuff. So New York tried to argue that, too. There was one other argument the states came up with. Anybody recall what that is?
Tax question.
Tax, right. The collection of taxes. New York was the one that came up primarily with this one. And what New York said is that they have to have this regulation in place because a substantial part of their revenue for operating the local government, the state government, comes from booze, taxing booze, and a lot of states, by the way, that's a big source of revenue for a lot of states. And the only way they can make sure that the out-of-state wineries pay the right tax is to jump through all these hoops. Buy 75% of the grapes from New York sources and have a brick and mortar operation in the state, and that was all dedicated to collecting New York taxes. Now, do you know of any other businesses that operate in states that don't have a physical presence and don't buy raw materials from the state, but that pay taxes to the state? Can you think of any? Have any of you ever bought anything online? Where'd you buy stuff from online? What companies? Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You must buy your textbooks. People buy the textbooks now online instead of going to the bookstores and so on. Right? Do you think the state's collecting tax when that transaction's occurring? Sure, the state's collecting tax. So what's so different about wine that would require all of these additional hoops to distribute wine in the state? Could the state show that it really needed to force the winery to have a physical presence in the state? Or could the state show that it really needed to have the wine made out of raw material from the state in order to collect tax? Does that make sense to you? No. So while the states tried to argue that they had a legal purpose, protecting the public, preserving the right to tax, and those would have been legal purposes had they been properly administered. When we look at the least restrictive means of achieving that end, the states could have done a lot of other things that could have protected the public against underage drinking and could have protected the state's ability to collect tax without imposing all these requirements on the out-of-state businesses. So because the states did not comply with this last requirement, that meant that those statutes affirmatively discriminated against interstate commerce and therefore were unconstitutional. Do you see how the court went through this? That's essentially what the court did. So if you read that case, it's a little bit difficult to, especially the first few cases are tough to get through because it's the language is different and understanding how the judges make the arguments sometimes takes a little bit to get used to. But essentially, if you read this case again, and I encourage you to read through this app now that we've been through this discussion, because it's going to make a lot more sense, and you're going to see how it applies specifically to the rules. The court did exactly this. Went through this process. It was a very structured approach. And it all goes back to that Commerce Clause power. So when we're dealing with interstate commerce, whenever we have interstate commerce, that's your decision tree to determine what law applies. It's either going to be solely federal, solely state, or some combination if we meet the requirements in between here. Does that make sense?
When the state's trying to say that the 21st Amendment applied, looking at it, I don't think I understand what they're saying.
Okay, let's take a look real quickly. What page?
596.
Okay. Okay, Section 1, the 18th Amendment is repealed. The 18th Amendment was prohibition. That was the one that said you can't bring booze into the United States. That's what made Al Capone rich, right? And all the mafia figures in Chicago and around the country. Okay, and then Section 2, the transportation or importation into any state, territory, or possession of the United States for delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof, of that state, meaning, is prohibited. So Section 2 of the 21st Amendment is essentially saying that you cannot bring alcohol into a state in violation of that state's laws. Now think about the time. This was back in 1933, right? People back in 1933 were a lot more conservative than they are now. Most people probably don't think alcohol is that bad of a thing. If you enjoy a couple of drinks now and then, who cares, right? You get to relax. It lowers your blood pressure a little bit. Might even be therapeutic or healthy in some cases to have a drink or two. No, don't want to have too much because that's bad, but a couple drinks are okay. So, but back then, there were a lot of concerns about what alcohol could do in society, what the impact of alcohol would be in society. So when they repealed prohibition, they basically gave the states the authority to regulate how alcohol can come in and how it's distributed in the state, and that's through Section 2 of the 21st Amendment. So you see the link there? It's the language is a little bit funny, but essentially that's what it says. It's trying to give that authority. Okay? Makes sense? Now everybody's silent. Now that could mean you're all tired, or you're all thoroughly confused, which I hope is not the case, or I'm boring you to death, which I would hope would be the case, because that means you've got this down and we can move on to other stuff. Which one is it? The third one? You got it all down? Good. Very good. So when you get a little factual situation like one of those questions up there that deals with a Commerce Clause issue or constitutional issue with regulation, you can just apply this matrix, right, and come to the conclusion. All you have to do literally is step through. It's just stepping through the analysis and figuring out which one applies. So if you just look at a situation and say, oh my God, how am I going to figure that out? That'll drive you nuts. If you just try and automatically zero in on what it's going to be, that's the wrong way to do it. When you look at the question, if you see that it has something to do with regulation, the very first thing you should be thinking of is Commerce Clause, and then just step through that matrix. And the answer will become apparent. It'll become very easy once you know that structure. All right. Any questions on that? No? Okay. Now, so that's enough on Commerce Clause. Let me just talk briefly about the Bill of Rights, and we'll pick up here next time. I won't keep you all the way to the end, because this is pretty heavy stuff compared to what we've done before. This is probably one of the three most difficult things in the course. Constitutional law, for some reason, seems to be one of the three. The three areas to watch out for are constitutional, contracts, and that always surprised me. I would think contracts would make sense to business students, right? Business majors, that's what all business is contracts. But for some reason, contracts seems to be a little bit of a problem. And then antitrust. That's another thing that surprises me, because all antitrust is a legal codification of the principles you learned in economics. Very simple. It's just trying to protect the interests of the participants in the market so that we can continue to have a free market. So we'll talk about those later, but if you've got this, that's really good. Now, the other area is the Bill of Rights. Bill of Rights are technically the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and those were put in place not really to benefit the government, they were put in place to benefit you. They preserve your inalienable rights, those inalienable rights that Thomas Jefferson talked about in the Declaration of Independence. They make sure that the government cannot take those rights away from you. And that's particularly important in a democracy. And when we talk about the First Amendment, this is going to permeate all areas of the First Amendment. When we have a democracy, it's possible that one group in society can get control of the government. One group could be in charge of the House, the Senate, and the White House. And if they're in charge, what can they do? They can pass laws that force you to do things that they think are right. And let's say we got one religious group into the government. So all the members of the Congress and the President are all members of the same religious group, and they're all on the fringe of that religious group and believe that they're right and everybody else is wrong. And they pass a whole bunch of rules that say you have to do these types of things and you can't do other things. What could that do? That could impinge on your rights to exercise your religion. That could affect other rights that you have, maybe freedom of speech, freedom of press, and so on. So the purpose, really, of the Bill of Rights is to protect you against the majority. It's to protect the minority against the majority. So even if somebody gets control of the government, there are going to be people out there that have rights that should not be able to be affected by governmental action. So these were put in place specifically to prevent the government from being able to take those rights away. Now, the First Amendment is interesting because it deals with rights of freedom of speech, press, religion, and assembly. Speech, press, religion, and assembly. We'll go through each of those in detail a little bit later. And the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment, 14th technically isn't in the Bill of Rights, but it's read with the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment, you already know. Anytime you turn on the cop shows on TV, what are people doing? Pleading the Fifth, right? What does that mean? If I plead the Fifth, what does it mean? It means I'm not telling you anything. And by the way, when we get to criminal law, I will try and emphasize that. If you ever get in a situation where you're in an adversarial role with a law enforcement officer, you don't tell them anything. Invoke that right, call your attorney in. You don't want to tell them anything. And I could parade policemen up that would say that. And you, because most of the time, especially in criminal actions, the police would never figure out what was going on if you keep your mouth shut. So even if you did something, if you don't talk, chances are they're not going to be able to figure out what happened unless it was super obvious. So don't talk to the police. They're not your friend at that point. They're trying to get you, and you don't want to talk to them. So the Fifth Amendment does that. It also has a few other criminal protections, which we'll talk about in a second. And then the big thing in the Fifth is it talks about due process. Due process. And that means that you have the right to certain protections whenever the state's trying to take an action against you. So if they're trying to bring a criminal action against you, or they're trying to take away your rights to freedom or your rights to property through that criminal action, they have to follow a certain process to protect your rights. The 14th Amendment deals with due process as well, and it says the states have to give you those rights as well. So there's something called the Incorporation Clause in the 14th Amendment that applies those due process rights to the states. And then the 14th Amendment also gives us another concept, an important legal concept, called equal protection. Equal protection of the laws. Everybody should have equal protection of the laws. So we'll talk about that. In fact, we have a case that deals with that at the very end of this chapter. So these two are read together. Now, I want to make a few points about the Bill of Rights, too, in general, before we look at the specific provisions. And actually, we may make those points and end up there and talk about the specifics in the next class because we're running out of time. But the Bill of Rights is kind of a fluid document because the way those rights are interpreted varies with the times. Now, in the days before 9/11, the courts were very, 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 very protective of all of those rights that you had in the Bill of Rights. When 9/11 came along, what did the government start to do? What kinds of things did the government start to do that limited your rights a little bit? Patriot Act. In fact, that's still an open question. A lot of people think the Patriot Act violates some provisions of the Bill of Rights. And in fact, some of the things that the president has done, the courts have said violate your individual rights, and the president's been enjoined from doing those in the future. So there has been issues about this. But when we have a time of crisis, national crisis, when somebody attacks us, 9/11 we were attacked, not by another state, but by a group of people who wanted to make a point. But anyway, we considered that an attack. When we're under attack, when our system's under attack, the government's going to buckle down and it's going to not give you quite the extent of those rights that you may be used to. They're going to shave back a little bit on some of those rights because the interests of society need to be protected, right? If we don't protect the society as a whole, you're not going to have those rights to begin with. So the point I'm trying to make anyway is that even though you have these rights to religion and press and assembly and so on, those rights can, the extent of them varies over time depending on the circumstances. And then there's one other major limitation on those rights. And that is if you start to impact the rights of other people, we're going to stop you from doing that. So let me give you a real simple example. Let's say that my religion calls for human sacrifice. Does the First Amendment give me the right to kill people because that's how I worship God? Can I do that? First Amendment says I have the right to freely exercise my religion. What do you think? If you just read it, that's all it says. Free exercise of my religion. My religion requires me to kill other people. Or maybe my religion requires me to smoke pot so I can commune with God. Does the government have to let me do the two? Nobody wants to answer. No, they don't. Why? Because it's now affecting the rights of someone else. If I commit a human sacrifice, if I put somebody up here and cut out their heart, right? I'm obviously impacting their rights. And they have rights as an individual that the government can't take away and I can't take away. So all of those rights are going to be subservient to the rights of other people as well. And same thing with pot. I can't just smoke pot because my religion. And every once in a while, by the way, people come up with this. You'll see this in the news sometimes, and this goes to court on a relatively frequent basis. Somebody comes up with a religion that requires them to use cocaine or pot or something else, and they say that they have the right under the First Amendment to do it. And the courts consistently say, no, you don't. Because that's something that goes a little bit beyond, and there's societal factors that have to be taken into consideration before we can let you do that.
Is suicide considered a crime?
Okay, it depends. In most states, yes. Suicide is considered a crime. And actually, this is something we can talk about now. There was a case a few years ago, the Gonzalez case, went all the way up to the Supreme Court. In fact, if you go to the U.S. Supreme Court website, you can get a copy of it if you want. Gonzalez versus the United States. In Oregon, there was a statute that allowed physicians to assist people committing suicide. So a physician could give you the drugs, basically, and tell you how to administer them. Now, the physician couldn't administer them. That would be a violation of their oath as a physician, first of all. So they couldn't do that. But they could give you the drugs and help you administer them. Well, John Ashcroft decided that he didn't like that. And all of you know who John Ashcroft is, right? Former Attorney General of the United States, where 3 years ago, he is a bit of a fanatic, religious fanatic, believed that his way was the only way, and anybody that didn't agree with him was on the mistaken path and leading to damnation and all this kind of. He was a little bit of an extremist when it came to this stuff. So he went in, and he said he sued the state. And he tried to say that those state laws were unconstitutional, were a violation of federal law, and therefore were unconstitutional. Went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, nope, the states can allow that. States can allow that. So in Oregon, it's allowed. But in Rhode Island, it's not allowed. Up here in the Northeast, we still have all those old Christian, Puritan-type beliefs, and suicide isn't going to be something that's going to be condoned here. So I don't know how you prosecute the dead person, though, if they commit suicide. But that's yeah. How would you serve process on them, right? It'd be a little hard to do that unless you can find some way, some gateway to the other world, and make that happen. But there's the Gonzalez case deals with that. So yeah, yes and no. Depends on where you are. Okay, so anyway, that's the Bill of Rights. When we come back next time, we'll look at those in more specifics. And next time, I will give you your first extra credit opportunity. So when you come in, I'm going to show you a little skit. And if you want to take advantage of it, you can do a little write-up on this skit based on the things we're going to talk about in the next class. So I'll see you next time.